is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
I started looking at stats of all the teams that were winning at our level on the national scene, and they all put the ball in the bucket at crazy numbers, right? They're all scoring in the high 80s, low 90s, even high 90s. And I thought, well, if we want to win big, this is what we're going to have to do, right?
Jason Smith has been the women's basketball head coach at Cedarville University since the beginning of the 2021-2022 season. He guided the Lady Jackets to records of 17-12 overall and 12-10 in the GMAC during his first campaign, while also qualifying for the GMAC tournament. 12 of his players earned spots in the GMAC academic team, while another was voted to the All-GMAC first team. Smith came to Cedarville after producing a notable 10-year run as the head coach at Bryan College in Dayton, Tennessee. He produced an impressive resume at Bryan, where he's the school's all-time winningest coach. Smith guided the Lions to an overall record of 219-85, including a 157-49 slate in the Appalachian Athletic Conference. His teams claimed 5 regular season titles, 4 league tournament crowns, and made 6 appearances in the NAIA Division II national tournament. Following his final season, Smith earned his 3rd consecutive AAC Coach of the Year honor, after which his team posted a remarkable 78-7 record during that time span, featuring a perfect 64-0 conference mark. He produced 9 consecutive winning campaigns, including an 18-3 record during the 2020-2021 COVID-abbreviated season. Jason previously served as the head men's basketball coach at both Calvary Bible College and San Diego Christian College. As an undergraduate at Kansas, he was a varsity manager and film technician for head coach Roy Williams.
Hey, Hoopheads. This January, our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball introduced their all-new CT Plus machine with a 21.5-inch touchscreen that allows players to train offline, build custom drills, compete in multiplayer mode, and view their stats in real time. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on their Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT Plus models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Coach Pascal Meurs from Belgium, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new FastDraw and FastScout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off FastDraw and FastScout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improve communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball.
Be prepared with your notebook and pen as you listen to this episode with Jason Smith, women's basketball head coach at Cedarville University.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here without my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight, but I am pleased to be joined by another Jason, Jason Smith, head women's basketball coach at Cedarville University. Jason, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Yeah, thanks Mike for having us and having me here. I appreciate the opportunity just to share my story, and you guys have been doing a great job just reaching out to coaches and letting them have a voice. You know, that's been awesome. So excited to have you. I wish Jason was here, but we'll get her done without him, you know. So you asked me, like, how did I start my basketball career as a young kid? I always tell people that I first grew up on a baseball field, to be honest with you. My dad was a baseball coach, a youth baseball coach, and before I was even born, and me and my brother spent most of our time on a baseball field growing up. I think I spent every birthday of my life on a baseball field. And then, like any good dad, he just wanted to get us involved in other sports. And he enrolled us into just a youth basketball league as a kid at the local YMCA. And that was kind of my first introduction to basketball. And, you know, I liked it. Baseball was my first love, but I liked basketball and just continued to develop the game and just play each year and get a little bit better every year. But I'll tell you, the love of basketball really started with Larry Bird, to be honest with you. Just start watching basketball and seeing Larry Bird play, I was just mesmerized. And I thought, I want to be like that guy. And then shortly after that, I don't know the time frame, but my dad ended up buying me and my brother a basketball hoop and put it in the driveway. And that was Katie bar the door at that point. I was done. I mean, baseball was fun and all, but I was hooked on basketball from that moment. And I spent hours and hours and hours outside on the driveway perfecting the game myself. And we, you know, I was always the Celtics, you know, I was always Larry Bird, and we always played the Lakers. And we always won, you know what I'm saying? So, and I just spent hours, and my parents would have to drag me in the house at night saying, you're going to wake the neighbors up. So as a kid, that's just kind of what I did. I just, you know, gravitated to basketball at some point. And I was a little pipsqueak. I wasn't very big. So I had to work for everything I did on the basketball court all my life. But even from the age 12, I would probably tell people, like, what are you going to, you know, people would ask me, like, what are you going to do with your life? I said, well, I'm going to probably be a basketball coach. That's what I want to do. So from an early age, I kind of knew what I wanted to do.
Did you look at the game from a coaching perspective even when you were young?
I think it was my junior high. You know, when I got into junior high and I was on a really good junior high basketball team, I think I started seeing things from a coaching perspective. I mean, I was a point guard. So I saw the game from every angle in many ways. I wanted to know how every position worked. I wanted to know, you know, what every person supposed to be on the court at all the time. So I was in that learning mode early on, definitely.
You were definitely thinking like a coach, because I think there's two, what I've found from the podcast, and it's been interesting, is almost everybody falls into one of two camps. They fall into the camp that you're in, which is, I've been thinking about being a coach from the time I was young. I was the coach on the floor. I was the point guard. I was the kid that was drawing up plays in the dirt or on a napkin or whatever. And there's those coaches. And then you have the other coaches who maybe they were players, or maybe they played another sport or whatever it was. And then they kind of get done and it looks like their athletic sort of playing career is done. And then they look around and say, wow, maybe I want to coach just so I can stay involved in the game. Or maybe somebody that's coached them see something in them that they didn't see in themselves. So I always think it's interesting just to hear from the two different sides of that coin in terms of, well, wow, this guy's been thinking about being a coach since he was 12. And then here's another guy who maybe he was playing overseas and now he's 35 and never even thought about coaching. And all of a sudden the game's kind of being taken away. And then you're like, okay, man, now I got to go and I got to get into coaching because I want to keep the game close to me, or as close to me as I can. All right, so I got to ask you about Bird. So when I was a kid, I was a Magic guy. Despised the Celtics, despised Bird, couldn't stand it. There you go. I understand. Well, Magic beat you in mind. So it's all even. But it's funny because you go back and I look, and I always try to think about, well, why did I like Magic and not Bird? Again, looking at this as an adult, and then I transitioned eventually to Jordan, and that became my number one guy. And I, you know, it's just, it is what it is. But I always try to think about, I'm like, why, what was it about Magic that I liked more than Bird? Because even going back to like the Michigan State, Indiana State national championship game, like I didn't really know much necessarily about either of those guys. I was like 8 or 9 years old. And for whatever reason, I just gravitated to Magic. And I kind of always, I guess, as I look back on it, part of me, especially with the Jordan piece of it and maybe Magic to a certain degree, I always felt like, well, Bird is kind of like, I feel like I could kind of maybe do some of the things that right. Bird does. Like, he can't jump. He's kind of slow. Like, I could kind of be like him. I'd rather be one of these guys that I have no chance of being, that are fast and Jordan can jump out of the gym. And, you know, I'm barely touching the rim at 6'3", you know, all these things. So it's just interesting to kind of go back. What was it about Bird? Was it just instantaneous, something that you didn't even really process? You just loved his passing? What was it about Bird?
Honestly, I can't think like exactly what it was at the moment. I think it was just his whole aspect of this game. I mean, you know, I still watch his highlights. I mean, when the feed pops up on Facebook still of you know, a 2.5 minute video of all his best plays, I still watch it every time, even though I've seen it 1,000 times, right? He still mesmerizes me, just the things that he was able to do without the athleticism. And as I got older, you know, just to understand how he approached the game too, you know, really a lot of respect. He was the type of guy that hated to be disrespected, right? And I think I always coached and I've always played with a chip on my shoulder. So I think I kind of gravitated towards a little bit of his attitude and not wanting to be disrespected, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when you go back into that era, I think everybody was either in the Bird camp or you were in the Magic camp. If you were an NBA fan in that era, you were kind of picking sides and deciding, all right, which one of those guys is my favorite? And so as you're talking about the chip on your shoulder and you're talking about a guy who I think maximized what he could do in terms of his skill set, when you think about yourself as a player, as you started to get more serious with the game and you got up into high school, what were some of the things that you were doing at that time? Because obviously it's a lot different. The way kids grow up in the game today is far, far different than you grew up in the game or I grew up in the game. So what were some of the things that you did to help make yourself a better player when you were in high school?
I mean, obviously watching a lot of NBA basketball and college basketball, I did a lot of that, to be honest with you. You know, the game was different. We didn't have all the AAU summer ball stuff like we do now. And really, it was just a lot of time in my driveway. I was small. I mean, I really was. At 16, I was 5'6", 110 pounds, you know. And I had to fight for everything I got to earn on the basketball court. So that's where that chip on the shoulder comes a little bit, is I had to work harder than everybody else to get minutes. Because I wasn't gifted athletically, necessarily. I was gifted with understanding the game and knowing what I'm supposed to be doing. But the athletic ability just wasn't quite there. So I just had to outthink people and outwork people. And really, it was just a lot of time in the driveway and watching film. I mean, my dad was he went to the University of Kansas, you know, so obviously there. And so did I. So growing up, listening to the Jayhawks basketball on the radio, I mean, we would still listen to all the games on the radio, and just that was amazing. I know that's a long time ago when you listen to games on the radio, but you know, but just to hear these announcers, I mean, you're just living this thing vicariously in your bedroom or your living room, listening to a basketball game. It's amazing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when I was a kid, thinking about being on the driveway, I think about listening to Joe Tate, who was the Cavs' longtime announcer here in Cleveland, and then also, I used to listen to a lot of baseball games on the radio while I was shooting on my driveway. And those are things that, again, I almost never do now. It's just that radio call has almost gone away. Who was your guy for Kansas growing up when you were a kid? Who'd you like at Kansas?
Oh, there was a guy named Ron Kellogg. I don't know if you remember Ron Kellogg.
Yep.
You know, he was a good shooter. He was a great shooter before the days of the three-point line. You know, I think if the three-point line out, he would have had some bigger numbers, you know. But he was my guy. You know, when listening to the radio to Jayhawk basketball as a kid, it was Ron Kellogg draining shots from everywhere, right?
Nice. There you go. Yeah, the game's so different. I'm sure we'll dive into that and talk a little bit about it as we get more into the coaching side of it. But, wow, you look at the way that the game was when you played or when I played, and it's almost unrecognizable in a lot of ways. You
go back
and
look
at things, and just with the emphasis on the three and the screen and roll, and that's just the spacing. It's incredible almost when you go back and watch old games. You're like, man, how did they not sort of figure that stuff out a little bit sooner? But again, the game evolves and changes and people eventually start to figure it out. And I'm sure 10 years from now, we'll be having the same conversation of, man, I can't believe we didn't really think about that. Or there'll be some rule changes that'll impact the game in some way.
Oh, there's no doubt.
Go ahead. What's your favorite memory of high school basketball?
You know, I would say one of my favorite memories is stopping one of my friends that played on the rival across town, right? I played baseball with this kid, and he was a really good basketball player. And I remember Coach putting me in a game in the second quarter, and he told him you need to go stop Jeff Hirschman in this quarter. And I pretty much did, you know. So I'll never forget that memory because it just, you know, meant a lot to me that the coach believed in me to go stop their best player, and I did it, you know. So I'll always remember that memory and never forget it.
It's funny the things that stand out. Like, I wonder if your coach remembers that moment.
I'm not for sure, you know. That's probably not, to be honest with you. You know?
Isn't it interesting, though? It's so interesting that you think about the things that we remember as players, and then you think, man, these coaches don't remember any of that stuff. Like, I can think of four, five, six things that over the course of my playing career that a coach said to me that
I'm sure if I went back to that coach and said, hey, do you remember, coach, when you said this to me? They'd have no idea. But yet those things had a huge impact on me. And that's something that I always think about as a coach, that when you're talking to a kid, you never know what thing you're going to say. And sometimes it could be positive, and sometimes it, unfortunately, it could be negative that sticks with the kid. And I think that's something that I've always tried to be cognizant of when I'm coaching or when I'm saying something to a kid, is this could be something that 40 years from now, he's talking about this on a podcast.
That's funny.
That, hey, yeah, Coach Mike said this to me. So it's just kind of interesting, the things that we remember as players or things that coaches said to us, that we got to think about that as coaches as well.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, you know, we always make mistakes, and those are the things when you go back and go, I wish I would have not said that, or you said I would have said that differently. We definitely have a huge impact on kids.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. All right, so as high school finishes, your dad went to the University of Kansas. Talk about your college decision and what you were thinking as you were heading off to college in terms of what you wanted to do for a career.
Well, I wanted to be a Jayhawk. You know, I grew up a Kansas fan, and that's what I wanted to go to school. So I just decided that's where I'm going to go to school. And so I enrolled at the University of Kansas, and I went to be a high school basketball coach, I'll be honest. I mean, I majored in physical education, and that was my plan, at least. You know, that was the thing I was thinking I was going to do, was, you know, go find my niche in college and be a high school basketball coach. And when I got there, you know, I found other things that were more intriguing, to be honest with you, like partying and girls.
Those are easy to find, right?
Yeah, those were easy to find.
Easy to find and pretty attractive,
yeah,
as well.
And, yeah, they definitely steered me the wrong way in many ways, right? But fortunately, I was really, you know, I was very beneficially lucky and blessed in many ways, because I had a friend in college say, hey, Jason, you love basketball. Why don't you just go see if you can become a student manager for the men's team at Kansas, right? So I said, well, yeah, why not? You know, so I just walked down to the men's basketball office and just said, hey, I want to apply to be a student manager. And they're like, all right, here's an application. I filled it out. And next thing you know, I'm getting called down to get interviewed. And all of a sudden, I get offered a position as a student manager, you know, with Roy Williams' staff, right? Roy had just been there a year. It was his first year, so it was his second year I was with him. And so I was a student manager for 3 years at University of Kansas, you know, for Coach Williams.
What was the interview process like? Do you remember, like, who you talked to on the staff? And were you nervous going into it, or was it just something you're like, well, if it works out, it works out. If not, where were you at mentally with that?
You know, honestly, I blanked that out. I cannot recall that interview process. I do remember talking with the head manager at the time, the head varsity manager. But other than that, I don't remember meeting with any assistant coaches at that time, to be honest with you.
It's interesting, because I was playing college basketball in the same era while you were at Kansas. So I was at Kent State from 88 to 92.
Okay.
And we obviously had a bunch of different guys that were managers for our team. And looking back, my perspective as a player, I realize now, and I've said this on the podcast a couple of times, but I had no earthly idea that some of the guys that were managers, that they were interested, or that it was even a route to becoming a coach. Never even crossed my mind. I'm like, oh, these guys, they just love basketball. They want to hang out with the players and be around the team. It's really cool, blah, blah, blah. Never once did I consider that to be like a track for somebody who wanted to be a coach. And now you look back on it, you're like, how did I not see that? When you think about, and I don't know how your experience was at Kansas, but our guys at Kent had a lot of access to our assistant coaches, and they're around, and you're having conversations, and they're in the office, and they're doing things. And obviously you're just able to pick things up as you're hearing conversations. But that's something that as a player never once crossed my mind. So I'm curious to hear like what your experiences were like. And obviously each year you get a little bit more responsibility as they trust you a little bit more. But tell us a little bit about the process of just what you did and how those relationships and what you got to do sort of built over time.
Yeah, Mike, I think you're like the rest of the players. You guys are all single-minded and privileged like the rest of these players were, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure.
I'm a college basketball player, right? You know,
yep,
who are these?
For sure.
These guys are just doing my laundry. Like, who are these guys, right? And at Kansas, it's probably even bigger, you know, just the stage that we played on.
For sure.
So it, like anything, it takes a while to build trust with people, you know, and building relationships. So, you know, when my first year there, these players and coaches are just trying to feel you out, and none of them know you want to be a basketball coach, right? And I'm just a young guy thinking, I'm not telling these people I want to be a basketball coach. You know, I don't want to embarrass myself.
Right.
Right. Cause I can remember the first few practices. I thought I knew the game of basketball, you know, and then all of a sudden I'm like, they're talking terminology I've never heard of, right? Roy Williams is saying, I'm like, I don't have a clue what he's talking about, right? And, you know, he's learned this stuff from Dean Smith. So I'm thinking, I'm so green, you know, I'm just going to be a fly on the wall and just sit back and just learn as much as I can, right? So it just took a while to build relationships. And, you know, the managers then, we did a lot of drills. We did a lot of drill prep as well and got involved in drills. And there's times when we had to actually – you know, we did scout team stuff as managers, so we got to play against the guys sometimes, right? So that was always fun, you know. And it was always fun to score on them or,
right.
You know, you'd gain respect from the players when you played hard and you worked hard against them. And so it was fun, you know, the next couple of years after that, you start building relationships with the players. I mean, I got to be pretty close with Rex Walters. You know, he was in some of the same classes I was with, and Rex and I would shoot for a couple hours before game, every game. And, you know, he liked to shoot for 2 hours before every game. So I would rebound for him for 2 hours, and then I would go take a shower and get in my suit and get back to the game, you know. But what a great experience. Went through a lot of coaches. You know, the first year I was a student manager for the JV team. They had JV teams, you know, back then, right?
Yeah, wow.
And Mark Turgeon was the JV coach, right? And working for Mark was amazing, right? He was just a young go-getter, and I learned a lot from him that year. And then, I mean, just some of the people that was on his staff have been amazing, like Jerry Green and Kevin Stallings and Matt Doherty and Truck Robinson. I mean, just the coaching staff, I mean, just to be able to learn from all of them was amazing.
When you think about Roy Williams as a head coach, and obviously Hall of Famer, national champion, has done everything you could ever possibly hope to do as a college basketball coach, what are some things that, when you look back on it now, made him who he was? What was so special about him as a head coach?
Very disciplined, very organized. Just came in and took care of business, and it was built good relationships with his players, you know. But ultimately, it was just his discipline. I mean, he was just disciplined in life, you know. He ran every day with his coaches. I mean, there was just daily routines that Roy did that just made him successful in many ways.
What were some of your day-to-day responsibilities? Obviously, you're building relationships with players, and you got a chance to shoot with Rex Walters and those kinds of things. But day-to-day, what was it like? What were some of the things that you had to do? And I'm sure it changed over the years as you got more experience. You probably got a little bit more responsibility. But just talk a little bit about some of the things day-to-day that you were doing.
Well, there's always laundry, right? That's the worst part, right? Doing laundry, cleaning the locker rooms up. I know this is going to be all glorification. You're going to love all this, right?
No, it's good, but it's reality.
There's
right?
no glory reality. In it. There's no glory right. in it, right? It's which is amazing, right? You just go. You're going to do the dirty work, and it's just cleaning the locker room, doing the laundry. I'm running the clock at practice, running drills, getting. You know, we had kickbacks. You know those shot kickbacks.
Yep.
Oh, that's old school. Like most
that's
people
old school.
Yeah, so kickbacks. So we had to set up kickbacks on the floor. We sometimes run drills. One year. I filmed all the games for him on the road, actually home games too. So so there's a wide variety of stuff that we did.
Well, when you think about film, right, and now you just plop the huddle camera up there in the rafters, and all your film work's taken care of. But back in the day, for young coaches out there, film was a little bit different when you're holding the camcorder, and then you got to make sure you're not making comments into the camcorder that people can hear, and then when you're actually trying to use the film. I remember sitting in our locker room and watching film and coaches using the clicker on the VHS and being like, all right, we got to see that play again, and hit and rewind. And it would go like 2 minutes past the clip. Then you'd watch all this stuff that was of no, you know, that they didn't want to show you again. You'd watch it and then they'd miss the clip again. It was just, it was so brutal compared to what we have today. It's
the equipment we had, Mike, was ridiculous. Like, it was like a TV camera. And then with the tripod was huge. Then you had a monitor and you had two DVD players you had to hook up together. So you'd have two recordings and we had to carry that up into the rafters. Yeah. Right. It was crazy. I can tell you one story. We were at Nebraska one year and we lost in overtime. But the end of regulation, one of KU players went up for a layup and Coach Williams thought he got fouled. He missed the layup and then we ended up going to overtime and losing. Right. So we're getting on the bus to go home and Roy yells at me. He's like, Jason, he goes, you got that videotape of the game, right? And I said, yeah, I got it. And he wanted to watch it on the bus because I know what he wanted to do. He wanted to go back and watch that play.
Right.
And so Max Falkenstein, I don't even know Max. He was like the old-time radio guy for Kansas Forever. He's legendary. He's in the Hall of Fame. But Max was – I was sitting next to Max on the bus, and he looks at me and he goes, Jason, I sure hope you got that on film. Right? And I go, I sure do too, you know. So I take up that video to Roy, and he puts it in the VHS there on the bus and watches. He scrolls right to the end of the game, right? And I got it, and Max is like, good job, son, good job, you know?
Nice.
So it was – I'll never forget that moment either.
That's funny. That's one of those cases where you no matter how good that relationship is, if that play hadn't have been there
– oh, I would have been in trouble, man.
Yeah, it would have been in trouble. Absolutely would have been in trouble. It's funny just thinking about those – again, those relationships. And I know, like, when I think about, like, our managers and stuff, and sometimes coaches get mad at them because they're running the scoreboard or doing whatever, doing the clock, and then, you know, we need 2 minutes or whatever. And just, it's funny just to think back again to those times and just how different your perspective was, as you said earlier, as your perspective as a player about what, you know, about what those guys were really doing and what they were all about.
Yeah, it was cool. I mean, just to see all the other coaches, too, was kind of really – because we were in the Big 8 then, right? And just to go to places and see all these different legendary coaches like Billy Tubbs and Norm Stewart. I mean, I had a conversation with Billy Tubbs in the locker room before one of our games at Kansas, right? It was one of those OUKU games that were like, we're number one, they're number two kind of deal, you know?
Yep.
And the Allen Fieldhouse is just rocking. And I remember walking into their visitor locker room to get something out of the closet, and Billy Tubbs looks at me and he goes – we don't have a chance tonight, do we? And I said, probably not, right? And so just stuff like that. Those are memories that are just flood my brain all the time.
Yeah, it's really cool when you start talking about college basketball, obviously at that level, and also at that time where college basketball arguably was as big as the NBA, I think now.
Oh, very much so.
You know, now I think with the way college basketball just has changed and, you know, guys coming into the league early and or going to the G League or whatever it is, it's just college basketball is not quite – it's just not at the same level in terms of national interest and being able to follow it the way you followed teams in that era while you were there at Kansas. So to be able to be a part of that and, as you said, to see some of those legendary coaches and just to be, you know, at Allen Fieldhouse and just – I mean, all that stuff, to be able to be a part of that, I'm sure it was super special. As you're there – your original plan is, I want to be a high school coach and a teacher. How does that plan progress as you're going through school?
Yeah, I mean, I ended up getting an adaptive PE minor. So I went to work out of college at this developmental learning center in Olathe, Kansas, and I was working as a paraprofessional in the, with these developmentally delayed kids in the swimming pool, doing work in the pool with them. But I wanted to coach, right? So I obviously couldn't coach there. So I found a coaching job down the road, about 20 minutes down the road at a local high school, a small high school in Wellsville, Kansas, Wellsville High School. And I was the assistant, varsity, JV, freshman coach, kind of, you know, just do it all. And got to work with a legendary high school coach there. His name was Kermit Dieterding, you know. So again, just an opportunity to learn from someone who's been doing it for a long time. And you'll laugh, Mike, because I don't know if you've ever seen this, but he ran an old school run and jump, right?
Okay.
I still to this day have never seen anybody else run it. And we were very successful running it, you know. I'd love to go back and pick his brain if I could at some point, but it was amazing. So we had a good experience there coaching. And eventually, to be honest, I just got dragged out of coaching And I had some friends that kept, you know, telling me, oh, you're never going to make any money coaching. You're never going to make any money teaching. And they were right about that, by the way.
Right? Yeah, they were.
They were totally right about that.
I'm right there with you.
And then I just kind of got swayed by the almighty dollar and decided to get out of coaching and chase a sales career. So I got into sales for a while, and it worked for a little while, but I was miserable for most of it, to be honest with you.
Coaching eventually called you back, right?
Very much so, yeah. I mean, and I met the right person. I met my wife that I have now, and she got me on the right track, to be honest with you.
Just through conversation of, hey, what do you want to do? And maybe she just saw that you weren't happy day in, day out with the sales job. Is that kind of how it went?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, she just, like, what's your dream? Like, what would be the dream? I mean, she had a great job. She was making great money. And I didn't know that when I met her, but that was a bonus. But
yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. But, she's just like, oh, I make good money. Like, what's your dream? Like, what would you want to do? And I just said, man, I just like to coach basketball and teach or coach basketball, but definitely coach basketball. And she was, well, what's stopping you, So just decided we're going to find a new track to do that.
All right. So how'd you do that?
Well, the first thing I think the biggest change in my life, it was in my late 20s. I mean, I got to say this, is I came to the Lord, right? I came to Jesus Christ as my Savior, and that changed everything, right? And so at that point, when I met my wife, I said, you know what? I'm just going to see what I can do. And the pastor that we were going to church at, he was an adjunct professor at this Bible college in Kansas City, Calvary Bible College. And he kept saying, Jason, why don't you just enroll at Calvary and get into some Bible classes and learn more about that. And I said, man, that'd be interesting. I'd love to do that. So I just went over there one day and started talking to him and said, I want to enroll in some Bible classes to learn more about the Bible. And they're like, yeah, you can do that. What else you want to do with your life? And I said, I want to coach basketball. And they said, well, you can do that here, I said, excuse me? I can do what? This is the counselor. I'm like, man, this is a great place, right? And I said, what do you mean by that? And he goes, well, I'm sure the basketball coach, could always use more help. So why don't you go down and talk to him, right? So I just strolled down to the gym and just talked to the basketball coach. And I said, hey, man, I'm going to take some classes over here. And I just want to coach basketball. And he's like, man, I don't have any money to pay you. And I go, I don't care about money. I just want to coach basketball, right? And so I talked to my wife, and so I just volunteered. My first year at Calvary Bible College, I was just a voluntary assistant coach, right? And that's how I got back into coaching.
United Basketball Plus is your doorway to all things basketball. If you desire to go further, faster as a coach and leader, if you want to maximize your team's potential, or if you simply just want to be a student of basketball, United Basketball Plus is the resource to take you to the next level in your basketball journey. As a member, you will have access to some of the greatest minds in basketball today. The in-depth videos provided by these coaches and basketball experts will help make difficult concepts simple to understand and teach. With your membership, you will have access to video playbooks, sports psychology, fast model playbooks, skill development, speed agility, and various other United Basketball Clinic videos. Your annual membership also includes access to our 2021 United Basketball Clinics, as well as discounts to attend future basketball clinics. The best way to find out all we have to offer is to visit us at unitedbasketballplus.com.
What did you like there about getting back into it? Obviously, now you're at the college level, which you had some experience at Kansas, but clearly not experience that is similar in terms of the level of play, but then you coached high school. Now you're back at the college level. Just what about getting back into it? Were you immediately like, oh man, this is where I belong?
Man, it was a small college, so it was real similar to high school level in many ways. So it was just getting back on the floor and teaching the game of basketball again. I always feel like practice is my time, right? And it's my time to really infuse on what I've learned from all these great people I've been around, And so it was just getting on the practice court and going, teaching these guys the game of basketball, right? And how they can be more successful doing what they're doing was just a lot of fun. I always say practice is my time and game times are for my players, right? So just excited to get back on the practice court.
What was slash is your favorite part of the game to teach? You like teaching defense? You like teaching offense? You like player development? What part of it is the most exciting to you in a practice when you get to really break it down?
And I think that changes. It's changed probably over the years. I think my style of play has evolved according to who we kind of have on the court and who we, you know, have in our program. So I can talk about that a little bit later, how it evolves in my career. But literally just breaking down ways to beat your defender, to be honest, is exciting for me. You know, the jabs, the way you move your body, the way you look off players, the way you pass fake, and watching players just pick that up, the little nuances of the game, and picking that up and then using them in a game and being successful. And they give you that little smile like down the court, like, okay, coach actually does know what he's talking about a little bit, right? And just that kind of light bulb that goes off in their head is real exciting.
How do you teach that? What does that look like when you're trying to teach that to a player? Is it a combination of you demonstrating, showing them what they're supposed to do, and then having them look at it on film? I'm just curious, how do you work on those individual moves, those individual things that a player obviously needs and can use to be able to beat their defender? But how do you teach that?
Well, obviously you got to have some on-court instruction. I think game film helps. What I usually find is I'll find a player that will execute the skill that I want to get across to the player. I'll find that in another player on film, and I'll show that player, like, okay, this is what I'm talking about. This is what we're looking, this is what I want you to be able to learn to do. Okay, so once they see it on film from a different player, you can see them go, oh, okay, now I know what you're talking about. And what I found with women, coaching women, is they don't watch enough basketball like men do.
Right.
Okay. So when you can't just tell them to go do something because they won't understand it as much, or most of them. I'm not generalized for everybody, but so you've got to really break it down on film and instruction on the court. And then you just got to keep repeating it over and over again. Whereas a guy, I think, picks it up a little bit faster because they just watch more game film or watch more NBA or college basketball than women do.
Yeah, it's interesting when you think about that. It's something that, I guess, just hearing you say that makes a ton of sense, but it's not really necessarily something that I've thought about before. But for sure, I think there's learning from osmosis, right? I mean, you grew up watching how many games over the course of your lifetime, whether it was in person or on TV, and, you know, I was the same way. And I don't think you consciously process, hey, I'm learning as I'm doing this. But when you think about it, it makes a ton of sense, right? The amount of time that you've spent just kind of recognizing patterns. It's that old thing where Albert Pujols got struck out by Jenny Finch, the softball player,
right?
And he couldn't read the cues because he just hadn't seen that. That wasn't what he was used to. And I think when you're talking about watching games and seeing it, obviously a player who's watched a lot of basketball and watched a lot of film and taken in all that stuff is probably better able to recognize those patterns. And I think that's a great point that you make that I really hadn't thought about when it comes to coaching on the women's side.
Yeah, I mean, I tell people I learned how to play golf by watching the PGA, right? Just watching it. No, serious. I mean, it's like,
yeah, no,
you watch
it.
Somebody swing and you start to emulate that swing. And then because I watched enough film, I could do that. I mean, some people don't learn that way. I get that. But I think a lot of people do. So, but yeah, definitely coaching women, I think you've really got to break it down on film and just repeat it over and over.
How long were you at Calvary before you became a paid coach?
1 year. So I was the volunteer assistant for the 1 year. And then after that, the head coach got dismissed, right? And next thing you know, I'm getting called into the office to be offered the job, right? So here I am, my second year into this whole deal, and I'm the head coach of this college, you know, Calvary Bible College. So it kind of happened way fast, more fast than I thought it would, right?
What did you know? What didn't you know at the time when you walked into it?
I didn't know how hard it was going to be. Like, I didn't know that there was a lot of good coaches, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Ultimately, I would say I didn't know there was that many good coaches at small college level basketball. And then I learned really quickly that I've got to figure this thing out, okay, right? Really fast, because we're going to lose a lot of games if we don't. So that was probably my quickest thing, is just learning. But it was, all I did was implement all that I did know. Okay, so it was just all Roy Williams stuff. I was into secondary break, right? I was into sideline, baseline, defense, right? It was just like, I'm going to copy Roy Williams stuff that my first couple years. And I'm thinking, he did it well, I can surely do the same, right? And so that's what I did. And it kind of panned out for me, so.
As you grew as a coach, as the years went on, and you start to kind of figure out your own style and what you wanted to do, and we'll get into your other stops along the way, but just in general, how do you go about learning new things about the game? Where are you going? What are your sources? Are you talking to other coaches? Are you going to clinics? Are you going to other teams' practices? Just what's your process for improving and growing as a coach?
Well, early on, 1 year at Calvary, I forget which year it was, but we ended up playing a game against Mid-American Nazarene, and Rocky Lamar was the coach. I don't know if you know Rocky, legendary coach. He just retired not too long ago. But the year we played them, actually, they won the national championship in NAIA that year. They were loaded, right? And so we go to their place early on, and they just smack us, right? They just run on the floor, killing us. And I called him up the next day or a couple of days after, and I said, Rocky, is there any way I can just come to your practices, right, and just watch your practices? And he's like, sure, coach, anytime, you're welcome anytime, right? So I went to a few of his practices and just watched what they did, right? And just gleaned so much information from that process. And really, it's just kept asking good coaches, like, what do you do? There was a coach down at Central Baptist Bible College in Springfield, Missouri, that was legendary. And, you know, I struck up a friendship with him and would just pick his brain, right? So I think being humble enough to know that you don't know everything is a good quality.
It really is.
And even now I'm the same way. Like I don't know everything, right? I still want to be in the learning process, the learning game. You know, the game has changed in many ways, and the kids have changed, right? So everything is such more relationship based now than it used to be. So learning that aspect of coaching is probably my next step. And what I'm trying to learn is, how do I be a better relational coach with my players versus just X's and O's and teaching the game, right?
How has your approach changed in that regard? As you're thinking about that, and you're starting to recognize that that's something that's different. And it clearly is. There's no question, when you go back to the era when you were at Kansas or the era when I was playing, that those relationships, not that they didn't exist and not that there weren't relationships, but it clearly was not something that I don't think very many coaches were sitting around the coach's office talking about, how can we build better relationships with their players. Now, sometimes those relationships develop naturally, but I don't think there was a lot of time spent thinking about, hey, we got to build a better relationship with player X so that they can play better and we can get to know them. So just how has your approach to that changed as you start to realize that, hey, this relationship stuff is really important to not only having a good experience for our kids, but also it helps winning, let's face it.
It can, very much so. I think it's tough for me, to be honest with you, because I'm that old school, tough, gritty kind of coach where I'm going to get in your face and I don't have much compassion for you when you don't do what you're supposed to do. You know,
yep.
It's just who I am, and I was built that way. Like I said, I have a chip on my shoulder, and come on, man. Like, that's just the way I am. So changing that aspect about me has been hard, but I know that it's something that needs to be done, and I'm working on it. I think it's surrounding yourself with good people. My assistant coach I got now has been really beneficial in helping me out through that process. She's been amazing about building relationships and how to do that. She had a psychology degree, so that's helped. I've got a good friend of mine that's a sports psychologist over at Cal Baptist that I lean a lot on just team building processes. And he's been great in helping me in that area. But it's a constant work. It's something that I think you always have to work at. I tell people I walk into my office every single day just to get just a little bit better, you know, 0.5% better. My job every day is to get our team better. And at the same time, I got to get myself better. You know, if I'm not getting myself better, our team's not getting better. So
yeah.
It's just engaging yourself in processes and just being aware of it. First of all, like, you got to admit that you have a problem. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Like, okay, I'm not good in this area. That's your first step. And then maybe After you say that to yourself a few times, you go, maybe I should search out for some help, right?
I think that self-reflection and introspection, to me, is one of the most important skills. I think just in general in life, I think it's so beneficial. But I think in coaching, it's super important, because if you're not willing to take a look at yourself and what you're doing, both in terms of how you're building culture, in terms of what you're doing X's and O's philosophy-wise, it's really easy for things to fly past you that are really important, because you're so dialed in on, I think I have everything figured out. And to your point, I think of myself as a young coach, and I was one of those guys that thought, hey, I was a really good player, and that's going to automatically make me a really good coach. And just like you talked about, hey, I did everything that Roy Williams did. Well, I did everything my high school coach did and my college coach did. And other than that, I really didn't know anything.
Yeah, that's true.
And I didn't really care to know anything else, to be honest. I'm like, hey, I played and I got all this stuff and whatever. And now you look back on it and you just think, I know way less about the game now at age 52 than I did when I was 25 and I thought I knew everything. It's just
amazing
how those things, how things change over time, and how your perspective as you, I think the more you know, the more you realize that you don't know very much, if that makes any sense.
Oh, it totally does. I feel lost many days in the last couple of years, you know, like, what am I doing, right? It's like, I know I've been doing this for a while. I know what I'm supposed to be doing, but there's times I still feel like I'm lost.
All right, so let's talk about the next opportunity after Calvary. You head out to San Diego. Beautiful place to go.
That was a
beautiful
crazy
place to go.
Beautiful place to go. I just a friend of mine applied for that job because he knew the vice president. And he's like, Jason, man, would you be interested in coming out to San Diego to be my assistant coach? And I'm like, man, I would consider that, right? And was a couple of days later, he calls me up and he's like, Jason, I don't think I can do that. I don't want to go out there. And he goes, but my buddy, I'm going to tell my buddy that they need to interview you, you know? And I said, you do that for me? He's like, yeah. And so I sent my resume in, and they interviewed me on the phone and then flew me out there, and I got the job. And everybody on the planet said, Jason, don't take that job, right? It just wasn't a good scenario at the time. But I did, you know, I didn't listen to them, right? I moved my family, my wife. I had two little kids. Like, actually, my son was just born. I mean, he was a little baby. And so we moved to San Diego, and yeah, you know, moving from a house in Kansas City, you know, with a $760 mortgage payment to San Diego with a $2,500 rent payment, right? You know, so it was crazy.
Yeah, it's a little bit. Yeah, San Diego, I always tell people, I'm like, San Diego is probably my favorite city in the country. But I'm like, if I was living out there, I'd have to live in a shack, and it wouldn't really be the lifestyle I don't think that I would want. Although, I don't know if I could ever go to work if I lived in San Diego. So I'm not sure how you did it.
No, it was hard. I mean, it was like a vacation for 3 years, I tell people, that sucked every dollar out of my savings account, right? Right. So, but it was fun while it lasted, and it was meant to be, and I'm glad I went. I don't regret it at all, right? It was a good times. Met some great people there, and I was at San Diego Christian on the men's side, still coaching men, you know, going into the GSAC then, that conference in the NAI was ridiculous. I mean, at the time, all those schools were still in the NAI. They've all gone D2. A lot of them gone D2 now, right? But I tell people that's where I really learned how to coach the game of basketball, you know, because I had to go against coaches that were unbelievable, right? You know, guys that won national championships and guys that won 800, 900 games. And you got the gamut of everything, right? You know, so Westmont would run the Princeton stuff, so I had to learn how to guard the Princeton stuff, right? Masters got into dribble drive stuff, so I had to guard the dribble drive. Azusa was, they had double flare backsides. Biola was three out, two in, high-low stuff. I mean, Concordia was in your face, on the line, up the line defensively. So every team was unique, and so you had to learn how to defend all that stuff, and that's why I tell people I had to learn how to do all that stuff, right? So it taught me a lot. It wasn't a great scenario, like I said, you know, basketball-wise for me, but I learned a lot.
Yeah, going against all those different coaches and having a scheme against all those different types of systems, I'm sure helped you as you continue to progress in your career. And then once you are done at San Diego Christian,
then what? You take a season off, is that right?
Well, I'd had a season off, and I went and helped a guy at Grossmont Community College in San Diego there for 1 year, my last year in San Diego. Doug Weber, he was at Grossmont, he still is. Good guy, actually. The funny part about Doug and I was we grew up next to each other, like less than a mile apart from each other in Kansas City, but never knew that, right?
Wow.
And so here we are in San Diego coaching with each other. And that 1 year of JUCO was enough to tell me I'm never going to do that again, right? That JUCO stuff was – that's crazy, man. So at that point, I needed a full-time job, obviously. I had two wife and two little kids. My wife had to go back to work. And so a friend of mine calls me up and said, hey, man, there's an opening for a women's job at Bryan College in Tennessee. And he goes, I know the men's coach there, and I know some people there. I can probably get you an interview. And so – I ended up getting an interview with them. They fly me out, right? And I thought everything went well. And they called me up one day and said they gave it to another guy, right? And so I was kind of shocked. But when I was out in Dayton, Tennessee, they were interviewing for the job. I talked to the men's coach, and he was looking for an assistant coach, right? So I called my buddy and said, hey, I didn't get the job, but you think the head men's coach would let me be the assistant? And he goes, oh, man, in a heartbeat, right? So let me call him for you. So he called me back in 10 minutes. He said, the job's yours if you want it, right? And it was a part-time job, Mike, right? Yeah. Paying like, I don't know, $9,000 or something, right? And I looked at my wife and I
got – that's a month of rent in San Diego.
Oh, yeah, you know? So I looked at my wife and I was like, I don't know, man. She goes, no, we're moving, right? No, we're going, right? So we just packed up our stuff and moved to Dayton, Tennessee for a part-time job, right?
All right, so you go from being a head coach, which I always think is interesting because you have that year as an assistant at JUCO. What was it like to transition from, again, head coach to these two assistant jobs?
I think it was good for me, right, because it got me to really sit back and learn the game some more, right? From a different, without the stress of winning and losing per se, because when you go to a program that's used to winning and you got to struggle for a couple of years, there's a lot of pressure there, right?
For sure,
there's a lot of pressure from administration sometimes through alumni, all that process. And I always tell people that my seat's always a little bit more stressful than 18 inches over, right? And that's just the way it is. So it was nice to be able to sit back and learn from a different coach and learn some different things. And the men's coach there at Bryan was really into defense, right? He was like, that was his deal. Like, we want to be the best defensive team in the country. And so he really helped me solidify what my defense probably should look like going forward, you know?
Yeah, it's amazing. Kind of, I always find it interesting when you talk to different coaches and how they pick up on one particular aspect of what eventually becomes their philosophy.
Sure.
In other words, like I learned some really great things on defense from this guy, and I picked up this on offense from this guy, and I picked up this culture piece from this person. I always think that that's interesting, that as you go to every stop, and it's a good lesson for young coaches that no matter who you're working for, you can always find things you like, and I'm sure at the same time you can always find things that you're like, ugh, if it was me, I wouldn't necessarily do it that way. So you try to pick and choose, and then eventually, as you mature as a coach, you start to get your own philosophy and sort of meld all those different things that you learned into one.
Oh, most definitely. I mean, obviously, you're still your own person, right? So, and you got to take what you like and what you don't like, and then just hodgepodge the whole thing to build your own style of play or how you see the game of basketball, right?
Absolutely. All right, let's talk about the transition from the men's side of the game to the women's side at Bryan. And clearly, you've grown up on the men's side of the game. All your experience has been on the men's side. So, A, what makes you think that the women's opportunity, I'm assuming the job opens up and you say, hey, it's an opportunity for me to get back and be a head coach, but how were you feeling about it? Was there any trepidation in terms of, I'm going to go over and coach on the women's side? Just what was the thought process there?
Oh, very much so. I'll be honest with you. I didn't want to coach women. I would have told all my friends and my family, it's not something I desire to do or didn't want to do, right? Like, no, we're not going to do that. So when the opportunity presented itself again, because the coach they hired was there for 1 year and it wasn't going to work out. So the AD approached me one day and he's like, Jason, this women's job is going to come open again. And he goes, I've got to know you for the full year that you've been here and would love to offer you the job, you know, when it comes open again. And I looked at him and said, I don't want it, you know. And by that time, you know, the program was kind of in shambles a little bit. The girls didn't have a great reputation on campus at the time. They ended up finishing last in the conference that year. So at that point, I'm like, no, I don't want no part of this business, right? And so he's like, oh, that's fine, Jason, that's fine. So it was a Friday night. I stopped by at this gym to go watch this basketball event, and I ran into my vice president of the school, and he looked at me and he goes, Jason, I want you to go home and talk to your wife about this job, and by Monday, I want you to come back and give me a better definitive answer, right? He goes, I want to know why you wouldn't take this job, right? Right. So I go home that night and tell my wife, I just offered the women's job again, you know? And she goes, you're taking it, right? And I go, no, I actually turned it down. And she looked at me, she goes, I trust you, but that's kind of crazy, right? So we talked about it over the weekend and decided, hey, I don't have a full-time job, you know? So she made sense of the whole process for me, and she's definitely smarter than I am, right? I definitely married up and outkicked my coverage with her. But so we decided, you know, I walked into my boss's office on Monday, that Monday, and said, hey, if the job's still open, I'd love to take it, you know? So, yeah, so I went in a little bit reluctantly, to be honest with you. But once I decided to take the job, I was heads in, full deep, all the way, 1,000%.
Did you talk to people? Did you talk to other men who were coaching women to get their perspective? Did you just kind of go in with a fresh eye and maybe not talk to anybody so that they didn't sort of cloud the way you were looking at it? What was your thought process as you were heading into that first experience, the first meeting with the team after you take the job?
I definitely called some people. I knew a couple coaches that had coached men before and then switched to the women's game. So I definitely wanted some advice from them. And I called them to talk to them. And one of the coaches, I'll never forget it, he goes, Jason, I just lie to my players every day. And I said to him, you do what? He goes, I lie to my players every day. And I go, dude, I can't do this. I'm a Christian man. I can't do that. Right? He goes, no. He goes, women, you just always got to encourage them and tell them that they're better than they are, okay? Because their self-esteem's that way. He goes, guys, you have to tear them down a little bit before you build them up. And he says, women, you're always got to tell them, like, they never think they're as good as they are, you know? So I got his point, right? And going in, I'm thinking that's probably more my style of coaching anyway. So I thought, we can make this work. And then I had another friend over at Lee University, Marty Rowe. He used to coach men and then coach women. I asked him about recruiting, to be honest. I said, Marty, I know how to recruit men, but I don't know this recruiting stuff for women. And he goes, I'll give you one piece of advice. He goes, don't care what anybody says about a kid. If you like her, then recruit her, you know? So don't listen to all the people. He goes, just trust your gut. And I said, well, it's pretty much what we've done. So great advice.
Yeah, interesting. When you think about the recruiting piece, let's touch on that real quick. When you're out there looking for a player, what are some of the things? Obviously, there's a certain requisite level of talent that they have to be able to play, that they have to be able to play at, again, whatever level it is that you're coaching. And probably you want them to be capable of playing a level above if you really want to be successful. But just as you're looking at players, what are some of the qualities in a player, whether it's actual basketball skill type things that you're looking for, or maybe even more importantly, just intangibles that you look for in a player that you know are going to fit in well to your program?
Well, the first thing I've always said is we're looking for great teammates. Like, you've got to be a great teammate. So those are one of the questions I always ask a coach. Is she a great teammate? And then we go into detail what that actually means, right? You know, I can never forget one of the kids we recruited at Bryan. She was out her senior year with an ACL. And me and my assistant went and watched her team play. And she wasn't playing. She was on the sideline. But she was the first kid up getting water for her teammates, right, when they came off the floor. And that spoke volumes to me, right? Like, this kid's a great teammate. So that's the first quality, is we want kids that are going to love each other well. And then I think on the court, I think I'm looking for players that were like me, to be honest with you, like players that had a chip on their shoulder and are not entitled, right? kids that are, we call them dogs, right? I'm looking for dogs. You know, kids, they're going to get in your face defensively. They're going to go crash the boards. You know, the Dennis Rodmans, those kind of kids, right? Kids that just don't have any entitlement and feel privileged. So those are the kids we're ultimately looking for.
The first training camp Elite Skill Development and Performance Combine will be held on the campus of Western Reserve Academy, just outside of Cleveland, Ohio, powered by Unleash Potential and the Hoopheads podcast. The camp is designed for boys rising to grades 6 through 9 and will take place June 29th through July 1st, 2023. An emphasis on improving individual skills in the context of a team environment will be the hallmark of the training camp. Mike Klinzing from Head Start Basketball and the Hoopheads podcast and Joe's Decision from Unleashed Potential will serve as the camp directors of this inaugural training camp. Campers can expect 3 days of hard work, intense skill instruction, and learning how to be a great teammate on and off the court at the training camp. Players will participate in 10 elite skill development sessions led by some of the best coaches from across the country. Visit headstartbasketball.com to get registered.
When you're out on the road and you're recruiting and you're looking at players, there's obviously two main settings where you're going to see them. You're going to see them with their high school team or you're going to see them with their AAU team. And clearly, this is one of the things that I think from a women's basketball perspective, the rise of AAU has just been incredible for the women's game because it just provides so many more opportunities for girls to play. Whereas when you go back to when you and I were playing or you and I were in college, there just wasn't, you know, again, as a guy, I could go out and play pickup basketball all the time. And I feel like that system, for me personally, I would enjoy playing AAU, but I loved my time playing on the playground, doing all those things. But that just wasn't available for girls and women. That just, you couldn't do those same things. So as now, you have so many more opportunities. But when you think about going out and watching players and you're watching with their high school team, you're watching with their AAU team, do you have a preference of which one you like to see them in? And also, what do you look at? Do you look for different things when you're watching with their high school team versus AAU? Just talk about the balance of trying to evaluate a player in those two environments.
Yeah, I think it's I think the AAU is probably more beneficial right now. One is you can watch more kids in one setting, to be honest. I mean, so it's a time saver for, you know, instead of driving to a high school game and watching a kid play for, you know, 32 minutes. May or may not play. Depends who they're playing. You know, they might be playing a bad team, so they only play 12 minutes, right? Stuff like that happens all the time. So I think the AAU is more beneficial. Second of all, in the AAU is the kids you're looking at are playing a stiffer competition night in and night out, and they're playing with better players around them, right? So, you know, a kid goes to a high school game that might have 25 points, and you're going, well, they played a horrible team, right? So surely she has 25 points. Of course she does, right? So it's hard to evaluate that process in my way. But when you're watching AAU, you're watching a kid play against really good players. So you're going to see him in that kind of setting and kind of see him how they react around good players, right?
It's really interesting just how, and I don't know if it's really shifted all that much since AAU has grown to be so much bigger, but the number of coaches who kind of have that same idea that you have, that being able to evaluate in AAU because of A, the ease of it, obviously there's a huge benefit to be able to go to some venue that has 10 courts and you can just walk and see 10 or 15 or 20 players, as opposed to, as you said, driving who knows how far to go see a high school game that may or may not be something that's worth seeing. It's just really an interesting piece of the recruiting process that, again, going back to a long time ago, it was the high school season, it was the high school coach, and now you've got much more involvement from the player's AAU coach and along with their high school coach. It's just interesting how those things have shifted and changed over time. All right. So as you're trying to build that program at Bryan, you take over, you're getting used to and adapting to coaching the women's game, and you're trying to get the program to where you want it to go. And ultimately you end up building it into a powerhouse, a team that you had a ton of success there, won lots of conference championships. What was, I guess if you look at it, if you had to boil it down to a couple things that you think you did really well that enabled you to build that program into what it became, what would you say are those most important things that allowed you to do that?
Well, obviously, you got to recruit good players. I mean, you're not going to do it without good players. And so I knew that going in, that we got to get better. We have to recruit better players. So what I figured out is, like, in our area, I'm going to go find the best teams, best high school teams in our area, and we're going to try to recruit their best players. And if their best players are too good for us, right, we're going to recruit their second best players or their third best players, because these kids have been taught well. They're learning. They're playing on a good team every year, going to state and all that. So that's what we kind of focused on to begin with. And, you know, it starts with one or two kids. You know, like Coach K would say, you know, Johnny Dawkins changed his program, right?
Yeah.
And I will say it started with one kid. It started with a kid named Keela Formant from, you know, Bradley Central High School in Cleveland, Tennessee. You know, she walked in from day one and said, Coach, we're never, ever going to have a losing record while long as I'm here, right? And that was just the attitude that the rest of the team decided to take on at some point. So sometimes it just starts with one kid like that. And she started 4 years at point guard for us and was defensive player of the year a couple times. And then you just keep building on that process of finding kids like that. And you got to be a little lucky. Sometimes you know that.
Right.
And find the right kids and catch lightning in a bottle. But
ultimately, you're recruiting winning, right? I mean, that's really what it comes down to, is you're trying to get as many kids from winning programs, whether that's winning at the high school level,
sure,
players who win at the AAU level. If you're winning at those levels, you're much more likely to have that be able to translate than a player who maybe is scoring big numbers, but their team isn't successful. I think coaches that I've talked to all tell me, hey, we want to try to recruit players from winning teams. We want them to be winning in high school. We want them to be winning at AAU, because
sure,
that translates.
But early on there, I learned that we had to defend, right? So, because we weren't very talented offensively. So we got really good defensively for the first couple of years at Bryan. And then each year I just decided we're going to start getting better offensively by recruiting better offensive players. And we slowly got better offensively every single year, you know. And unfortunately, some of our defense went away, but you know, I started looking at stats, you know, of all the teams that were winning at our level on the national, you know, scene, and they all put the ball in the bucket at crazy numbers, right? They're all scoring in the high 80s, low 90s, even high 90s, and I thought, well, if we want to win big, this is what we're going to have to do, right? And we kind of fell into our evolution of the game by accident in many ways. We didn't purposely fall into it. We recruited a couple kids 1 year that could shoot it, right? They were really good shooters. And one of the kids could shoot it really deep. She'd be shooting behind the volleyball line at a really high rate. And so we just started, like, every kid on our team could shoot threes, right? So, you know, we talked earlier about the evolution of the game. Like, Steph Curry changed the game. Right? So we just, you know, we started recruiting players that every single kid can shoot it. You know, like, if you can't shoot it, we're not recruiting you, you know?
Right.
And I don't care if you're a five or whatever. If you're a five, you're going to go out and shoot it. So that kind of became our style, because the crowds just started coming out when our kid was making threes from 30 feet, right? You know?
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
And I remember, wait a second, these girls can't dunk. The only thing that they can do exciting is, you know, just rain it from the three, you know? So we started doing that. And I'll never forget, we were at Pikeville one time and she pulled it from two steps over half court one time and drained it, right? And the crowd, their crowd went nuts. And I'm like, hey, man, this is fun. So we just started recruiting to that process, right?
It takes a different sort of mentality as a coach, right? You kind of rewire your brain.
Oh, really much so. You had to live with a few bad shots. But, you know, but I also realized, like, teams started to guard her out there, which was stupid, by the way, but because it just opened up the basket.
Right.
And so we were scoring layups galore at that point, too.
Yeah, it's amazing what the spacing has done, the shooting, and it'll be interesting to see how the game continues to evolve and whether there's rule changes or whether sometime at some point they move the line,
I think the
line back, or what's going to happen.
I think the line going back for us this last couple of years has hurt the game a little bit, because I think it's too big of a jump for the high school kids right now.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, when it was just the one before, I think they transitioned pretty easily, but now it takes our freshmen a little while to get transitioned into that.
Yeah, I'm sure. I can imagine that. All right, let's go from Bryan to Cedarville. Tell us about leaving what you had built there at Bryan for this new opportunity at Cedarville. What made it the right job at the right time?
Honestly, Mike, I just felt like led by the Lord to come here, you know, because I think I had it going good at Bryan. I mean, I tell people I could have stayed there and probably kept winning championships there for till I retired, to be honest with you. We had it rolling pretty good. It got to be pretty easy. And I guess I just needed another challenge in my life, you know, to ultimately. And then I think there's always a part of you that thinks, okay, can you do it at another level? You know? So there was just a time for a new adventure in our lives, to be honest. And it was the right fit personally and professionally for, you know, my viewpoints in life and my worldview in life. And so it was just the right fit at the right time.
What was the first thing they had to do when you came in and you started looking at the job and trying to decide, hey, am I going to take it? And you make the decision, this is where we're supposed to be. What were the first one or two things on your radar that you felt like you had to get going right away to get the program moving in the direction you wanted it to?
Well, I think it's I don't know if that's a good question for me, to be honest with you, because I think the program had been in a good place. And it probably was still in a good place when I took it over. So I think I didn't want to take some just rebuild job, to be honest with you. But there was a lot of challenges with our team last year with things. We had three ACLs early on last year. Three of our top six players we lost within the first five games of the year, and still found a way to finish 17-12, fourth in our conference. So I'm proud of that. But honestly, and then we lost four seniors off that team. So we're almost like wrapped back in the rebuild quicker than I thought we were going to be in the rebuild, if that makes sense. So I'm almost back in first days at Bryan, where we're at right now. So it's going to be a little bit longer process than I thought it was to get back to the top of our conference, to be honest.
So how much of it is recruiting? And then how much of it is what you need to do in terms of what you're putting together on the floor and the culture? How do you balance those two?
Oh, my gosh. That's difficult. Okay, very difficult. Because they're simultaneous, right? Because culture changes faster nowadays than ever. And you got to stay on top of culture or you'll lose it within 30 seconds or to a day sometimes. I know that sounds really bad, but it's true. I think it obviously starts with recruiting. You know, you've got to have good enough players to compete at this level or you're not going to compete, right? I mean, it's really,
right.
I mean, we're just at a point where right now we've got to just find more talented players. But within the same process, there's always culture building. When you come into a new program, you've got kids that you didn't recruit. They didn't come for you, you know. Some of those kids will buy into what you're doing, some won't. And there's nothing you can do about that, right? The only kids that are going to buy ultimately into your program are your own kids. So you just got to go find your own kids.
What do you do with the ones that are returning, the ones that do buy in? And what do you try to build with them and then combine them with the new recruits that you're bringing in? When you think about building the type of culture that you want to build day in, day out, what does that look like? What are some small actions that you take that you want your players to take in order to build the kind of culture that you need?
There are conversations, you know. You have to have conversations over and over and over again. Like I had a player in my office this afternoon just talking about culture going forward. Making sure that she knows exactly what we're looking for and being specific and giving her specific things to do on a day-to-day basis. So you have to be specific with them. Then give them almost like a detailed list, like, oh, you need to do this, this, and this this week, you know? Because I'll be honest, these kids, I mean, Cedarville's a tough school academically, right? So, and we want kids to do well in the classroom here, and we recruit to that. And the demand on their classwork's high. And we want them to succeed here, right, academically, because ultimately, you know, they're not going pro. Most of our kids aren't going pro. So they need to be able to get good jobs and have good careers. So there's a demand on them, and they're going to focus high on that process. And sometimes they'll forget about basketball stuff, right, or building relationships. So we just have to constantly remind them.
So beyond that academic piece of, hey, you got to make sure you're taking care of your classwork, or you got to make sure that you're on the court doing whatever. What are some things that, when you talk about some things that you need to do on a weekly basis, let's give me an example of a conversation that you have with a player of, like, culture wise, here's a couple things that we need to get done in the next few days.
What's it? This is funny because my dad taught me this. My dad worked for Hallmark Cards for 30 some years, right? And he managed a lot of people. And I've learned a lot from my dad in the business world about things. And one of the things he told me was, Jason, as a coach, you got to find win-wins for your players, right? On the court, off the court, whatever's a win-win, win for you and win for them. And so we find ways to do that in many ways, right? You know, if we want to get a shooting drill done in practice, and sometimes we'll just ask them, what shooting drill would you prefer to do? As long as it accomplishes the same goal, you know, we're going to do it. And the same thing off the court. So one of the things how my dad used to manage people at Hallmark was he'd manage people by just the random pop-in, right? He would just pop into their cubicle and just visit with them and get to know them and understand them. He very seldom ever called an employee into his office, right, because it puts him on the defensive. Unfortunately, I have to call kids into my office because I have nowhere else to meet them, you know. But I can't do the pop-in, unfortunately, because I'm a man coaching women. But what we try to do with our players is we try to teach them they're the ones needed to doing the pop-ins. And so, you know, as an upperclassman, you know, we have some townhouses, so our upperclassmen live on townhouses. And I tell our upperclassmen, like the one today, you know, you just need to pop into our underclassmen's dorm room, you know, just do the random pop-in. And I know that sounds so silly, but it's so worth so much, right, of just building an impromptu relationship. And they're like, what do I say? Or just pop in and say, hey, what's going on in your day today? You know, how was your day today? And just let them talk and try to teach them to ask questions and just shut up and listen, right? I mean, basic human interaction, right?
Right, absolutely.
So sometimes it's just teaching those skills. And then try to teach them to always give their teammates the benefit of the doubt, right? I think we're so quick to judge in today's society that instead of giving our brothers and sisters just the benefit of the doubt, right? And if they say something silly, you know, just we teach our players to, you know, work it out. You know, go up to them and say, what did you mean by that? You know, here's what I heard. So simple relationship building thing. I think this world needs more of that.
Yeah, it does for sure. And I think that it's something that we oftentimes, I think as adults, we forget or maybe we take for granted that kids at all ages, they need some of that guidance. They need some of that talk about, well, what does that look like? Because so often we say, and I think this is something that happens with a lot of coaches where you're talking about, hey, you hear coaches complain a lot about we need more leaders on our team, right? You hear leadership is something that our team's lacking. But then oftentimes you look at it and you say, okay, well, what does that really mean? Like the kids, it's easy to get confused because coach wants me to be a leader, but I don't really know what that means. Or coach doesn't create space for me to be a leader. Or coach doesn't explain to me what being a leader looks like. And now all of a sudden, I'm just kind of left floundering in terms of what I'm going to do. So I think what you just said about having those conversations of explaining, okay, we want you to pop in, but what does that actually look like? What am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to say? And I think by giving kids that guidance, now you've given them a framework to sort of build off, and then they can inject their own personality into it. And I think that's when, obviously, as a coach, you want your players to be taking the lead on the culture. That's when you really know you have things going, like you talked about, when you get that one or two or that class that comes in and they just get it and they're able to kind of take that and run with it. And then boom, now you really got it flowing. It sounds like that's kind of where you're headed, what you were able to do at Bryan, where you're headed here with Cedarville.
We sure hope so. I mean, I think kids operate out of fear so much, right? Because I think most bad decisions are made from an insecurity or from fear, right? And trying to understand that as a coach at my age is not easy to do, right? But yeah. But my wife's been really good at teaching me that process. Like she will just always say, Jason, they're making that decision out of fear, right? Their fear of failure or fear of being embarrassed or fear of whatever, right? And it makes total sense, right? But trying to change that mindset and get them in a different frame of mind is a process that I'm trying to implement. I'm not going to say it's easy. It's a hard process. But ultimately, I think that's ultimately more rewarding than winning basketball games.
How important is your assistant coach in making that happen?
Well, right now she's big in that process just because she's way better at that relationship building than I am, to be honest with you. She's really good at it, you know. So, and she's done a great job of building that into them as well. But it takes time, right? It just takes a lot of time of relationship building. I mean, I can look back on some of my kids I had at Bryan, and we walked the walk, you know. We cried tears together in offices. We laughed together in offices, right? So there's something, there's a shared experience when you go through adversity as well, Mike, in that locker room. Like when you share it, wins and you share adversity, there's just something about it that should draw you closer to one another, right?
Yeah, it absolutely should. I think in the best cultures, that's what happens, right? In the best cultures, adversity brings you together. And in a culture that's not healthy, adversity tears you apart. And I think as a coach, that's one of those things that if you can get your team, get your program to the point where when things don't go well, you kind of circle the wagons and figure it out, that's when you know you've got something and you know that your team is going to be headed in the right direction. And it's not always easy to do. I mean, it takes time and it takes effort, it takes energy. And like you said, it's a process that I don't think anybody out there, I don't care whether you're in the business world or whether you're a coach, whatever it is, that it's not easy. That stuff doesn't happen by accident. Like your family with your own kids. My wife and I always have this conversation about just kids being polite as an example. Like, you know, that doesn't happen by accident. Like, you know, when you see kids who are polite, you know, their parents have spent hours and hours and hours and hours and hours getting those kids to be polite and modeling that for them. And I think coaching and culture in a lot of ways is very similar to that. There's a lot of stuff that goes on behind the scenes that people see a culture in a game on a Saturday afternoon. And you're like, wow, look at that team. They're together. They're playing and they love each other. And okay, great. But you didn't see all the work that went into making sure that that actually was what we're putting out there for the public to see.
Yeah, it's really interesting because, you know, when I was at Bryan and the recruiting process, I just started asking every recruit this question was, hey, well, what's the most important thing you're looking for in a school? And you know what? Almost every single one of them said, they said, I just want to play with a team that likes each other and gets along.
Wow. That's powerful. That's powerful.
It's powerful. I heard that over and over. And that was with women. I don't think men would ever say that. But and they just kept saying it over and over. And I'm thinking there's something to that, obviously. So I said, you know, if that's what you want, that's what we're going to try to produce. And that's what we're going to recruit to. And that's what we're going to create. And I go back to one practice. I don't even remember when it was. I just remember something coming out of my mouth, and it sounded really good when I said it, you know. I said, ladies, it's my job as your coach to love you, but it's your job to love each other, you know. And that kind of became our mantra. Like, that's kind of my mantra in coaching, right? It's my job to love them. That looks in different ways or comes out in different ways. But ultimately, it's their job to love each other. And so we're trying to get that process going here at Cedarville.
That's really well said. I think that hearing you say that so many of your recruits said that they want to play on a team where everybody gets along, where the players love each other. Like, that to me is such a powerful statement because I know that you've been around or seen teams where that's not the case. I've been around and seen teams where that's not the case. And even if you're the leading scorer on that team, and you're getting every shot you want, you're playing 39 minutes. If your team isn't getting along and doesn't like each other, it's not really a fun experience. Versus, now look, everybody likes to win, but you can have a positive experience with teams that maybe aren't as talented, that maybe don't win as much, but you know as a coach that you can have just a blast coaching a team that's together and plays for each other. And it's a powerful thing. It's amazing that kids, I'm kind of surprised that they articulate it in quite that way. And like I said, I'm not sure, as you said, that maybe boys wouldn't say it in the same way. But I think probably if you dug deep enough, I think they'd probably say the same thing.
They might. I just haven't coached them for so long, so I get it. But, you know, at Bryan, we got to be pretty darn good. So it was, we just told players when we recruited them, hey, you know what, you may not win very many awards as an individual, but you're going to win a lot of games. You're going to play 20 to 25 minutes at the most, okay, because we're going to spread the ball and share the ball, and you might score 15 one night and 5 the next, but we're going to win a bunch of games. And And you know what's funny is they all bought into that process, right? They figured out winning games was actually fun.
Absolutely.
And you know what? I don't need all those accolades because they're just dust on a shelf at some point, right?
Right. And at some point, I think the biggest thing is there has to be communication from the coaching staff about what that's all about. Because I think kids, players, they judge themselves by how many minutes do they get? How many points do I score? That's what everybody asks them about. And so it takes a sort of rewiring of the brain in order for kids to really come to that. Now, some kids have it naturally, but a lot of kids sort of have to be rewired. And I think as a coach, the way you do that is you got to constantly be communicating. You got to be constantly making sure that kids understand the value, whether they're playing 10 minutes or 15 minutes or 25 minutes, whether they're getting 15 shots a game or they're getting three. You got to constantly be communicating the value that those kids bring to the table and making them understand what their role is in that whole bigger machine of, hey, we're all together, we love each other, and we're going to win some games along the way.
Sure. I think you hit something on the head when you're talking about value, right? I think every kid on your team has value. I mean, first of all, as a Christian man myself, I mean, every one of my kids is made in the image of God, so that's how I'm going to treat them, right? So, but they all have value, right? And their value has to be more than minutes or points, right?
Absolutely.
It has to be because that fluctuates every game, right? So there's no way you as a coach could say, oh, so-and-so player, I value more than so-and-so player, because that's impossible. So I had a young lady in my office not too long ago because she hasn't played much. And I just had to remind her that she still has value, right? She still brings value to the team, and just had to get that out of her. Like, what value do you think you bring to the team? And when she answered it properly, and I said, well, there you go, right? Just because you're not playing minutes doesn't mean you don't bring value.
And you got to be intentional as a coach about that.
It's hard because some kids will talk to you about it and some won't.
Right.
Right. So some kids come to your office and some won't. That's just the way it is. Again, the fear thing, right? My office is always open, and the more conversations we have, the better. I got one of my players that just needs a weekly reset. She just comes in my office every week and just goes, hey, fix my head, coach, fix my head.
That's funny.
And guess what? She leaves every practice, the next practice after she comes in my office, she has great practice, right?
That's cool. That is very cool. That she knows herself.
She knows herself. And like, again, we had to reset a kid kind of mentally this week. She was struggling and just not playing well and not having good practices. And then, you know, Monday came along and I looked at her and I said, we're resetting you, you know? She's like, what do you mean? And I'm like, she goes, I don't know how to fix my game. And I said, but I do, you know? And I said, here, and she goes, well, how? And I told her, I said, here's what you do. You just do this one thing today in practice. And so she did it. And then the next day I said, well, you know, you do this thing, you know? And then she did that. And then Wednesday, you know, she had a great practice, and tonight we ended up losing the game, but she ended up having 18 points, right? Her best game of the year. Completely just reset the whole, you know, her whole mindset.
Confidence, right?
It's just crazy, right?
So much raised confidence.
And you think, well, if all my kids would do that, maybe we would be on track, right?
Yep, absolutely. All right, we are headed, Jason, towards an hour and a half, so I want to wrap up. One final question, two-parter. So part one is, when you think ahead to the next year or two, what's your biggest challenge on the horizon? And then number two, when you think about what you get to do every day, what brings you the most joy? So your biggest challenge and your biggest joy.
You know, I think the biggest challenge is just finding enough players that will fit into our school and that can help us win basketball games. You know, I think we got a good incoming class next year, but they're still going to be freshmen, right? In our league, freshmen don't, you know, it's a junior, senior led lead for the most part. So freshmen usually don't come in and dominate by any means. So I know it's just going to take some time. I mean, we're 2 or 3 years away. So it's just being patient is probably the biggest challenge for me and for anybody that works here, administration and vice versa, you know. And then the things that get me the joy is just getting better, like the resetting that kid's mind this week and watching her go perform tonight. That's basically what gets me going, right? That brings me back the next day thinking, okay, there's something there, right? Don't give up on this kid, right? She's obviously, I recruited her for some reason, you know? And my dad will tell me, you obviously recruited her for some reason, Jason. And I said, yeah. And I saw it tonight, right? So those are the fun times. being able to have those conversations, and ultimately just seeing the light bulb go off with kids. You know, like the conversation I had with one of my players in my office today, just great conversation about culture going forward. Those are the things that I really enjoy talking about.
Well said. Before we get out, I want to give you a chance to share how people can find out more about your program, how they can reach out to you, connect with you, whether you want to share social media, website, email, whatever you feel comfortable with. And then after you do that, I will jump back in and wrap things up.
Yeah, I mean, our website is yellowjackets.edu, Cedarville University. I mean, you go check out our university. The university's growing, doing some great things. We're one of the few schools that's actually growing. Our enrollment's going through the roof. So come check us out, cedarville.edu and yellowjackets.edu. You know, personally, I'm on Twitter just for women's basketball. Once I'm done coaching basketball, Mike, I'm off social media for the rest of my life. You know?
I understand.
So you can follow our Twitter page. I don't even know our handle for our Twitter page. That's pretty bad, isn't it? I don't even do it very much. But
we'll do some research.
You can figure it out, okay? You guys are more savvy than I, but then my email is jasonsmith@cedarville.edu. You guys are more than happy to reach out to me. And love to visit with coaches. Like I said earlier, I got so much more to learn, especially if you got anything about relationship building. I need to know that stuff, so send it to me.
Perfect. Jason, cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule tonight to jump on with us. Really appreciate it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks. Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.